What does it take to become a doctor? How does that affect their attitude towards a patient? Has the relationship between physician and patient changed in the past decades? Join me, Corinne Fregoni, in a conversation with Dr. Victoria Sweet about her new book, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing, next on Through the Eyes of Women. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. I was lucky enough to interview Dr. Victoria Sweet a few years ago about her last book, God's Hotel, and we had a great discussion about her experiences working at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, the last almshouse in this country before it was shut down. When I found out that Victoria had just had another book published called Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing, I jumped at the chance to talk with her again and explore her ideas about medicine and what's happening in this country that might be interfering with a trusting relationship between doctors and patients. And, more importantly, how we can all heal. Victoria, thank you again for coming to the show.
Well, thank you again for having me.
You open your book, Slow Medicine, with a story about your father. What happened?
Well, it's really what it gave me the thread with which to tell the whole story of the book. So Dad got admitted to a hospital with the wrong diagnosis. He had a seizure, and they thought he'd had a stroke. So, okay, everybody can make a mistake, but they couldn't change the diagnosis in the electronic health record. And because these days nobody actually looks at the patient because they're so stuck at the computer, I couldn't get anybody to recognize that it was the wrong diagnosis. So for 10 days, he was being treated as if he were a stroke victim, even though he hadn't had a stroke. So he almost died. And we finally, the only way I could get him out of the hospital and off those medications, out of the whole environment, was to tell the docs that we had made him a hospice care. So then they took out everything and we took him home and then he recovered. But I was so shocked by this disconnection, really, between this beautiful hospital and these docs and nurses that were well-trained, experienced people who cared, and the fact that he had the wrong diagnosis and they couldn't get off this conveyor belt, this assembly line of providing health care, really. So I wanted to know what had happened. So then I ordered up his health records, right? Because I wanted to see, maybe I'd missed something. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe he had had a stroke. And I went through them. In 10 days, they had generated 812 pages of electronic health records. It took me 4 hours to go through them, Corinne, and I'm good at records, right? I know what I'm looking for. I could not answer the two questions I wanted to know, which were simply, what medications was he getting, and how had he gotten that diagnosis, even though I went through all of them. So that really made me think about what had happened to medicine and healthcare, and what could I do to help reverse the course or add what we've lost? And that's why I ended up writing the book with the energy that it has.
You emphasize in your book the difference between medicine and healthcare. Everything is healthcare, healthcare, healthcare. Tell us more about that.
Well, healthcare, I think, is, I found a very weird model. And the first time I ever heard the word being a healthcare provider, I literally stopped in my tracks and looked at the guy who'd said it. I'd never heard it before. And the idea that when a patient who's sick and vulnerable comes to me and I have a profession called medicine and I try and understand what's going on and examine them, but that was something called healthcare and I was providing it as if it were a box of healthcare on a shelf someplace and I would take it down or was it in a vending machine and you like put money in and a box of healthcare comes out for you was very bizarre.
Wouldn't it be nice if it would be so simple?
Corinne, I love the way you think. I've asked myself about that. I sort of said, okay, let's take this idea to the nth degree. Imagine that everything that they're planning to do with healthcare really works, right? It's going to be virtual. It's, you know, you're going to have Dr. Robot on the computer. You're not going to have to go see your doctor. Everything's going to be there. And so I'd like to imagine that, right? It's like 10 years from now. So imagine, like, suppose you could stick your finger in your computer and you could get a diagnosis, and then Amazon would be connected to your computer and it would drone you the right medicine. Like, how about that as a model? And I was like, that would be great. Man, just think, you never had to go to a hospital. You never had to get in a CT machine or an MRI machine. But then I thought that's actually impossible because what really happens, I mean, it's fine if you have a stubbed toe, But when you really are sick, it has nothing to do with that model, right? You're sick. Something happened. Oh, my God, you've got a lump growing out of your, neck. You've got acute abdominal pain. You're vomiting. I mean, you're not going to, it's not relevant. So I think if they could make it so that you could get a box of healthcare out of a vending machine, great. But I think it's just as impossible as, we're not flying around in cars, I notice, which is what they'd shown us that we were going to be doing when I was a kid in the modern universe, right? We'd all be flying in cars and all that stuff. I think it's that kind of idea. So if they can do it, great. But my experience as a doc and as a patient is when I'm sick, I want somebody to take care of me.
Tell us about that experience you had as a patient, and it seems to have been a turning point for you.
Yeah, that's actually quite a hard one for me to tell, because it was a turning point. I was doing my residency in San Francisco in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, and I was doing a residency in internal medicine, and they're very, very strenuous. Not as strenuous today as they were then, and because I was at Kaiser, I mean, it was just unbelievable. I mean, I was working about 115 hours a week, literally, and I'm pretty efficient. So I was pretty depressed and exhausted and disillusioned by what I'd been seeing there in terms of all that effort, and didn't seem to me to really be helping people very much. And I was just about ready to quit, even though I didn't want to quit, but I felt like I was losing my humanity and not doing anybody any good. And it was, we switched for a month, and instead of being the second year resident, I was the third year resident. And it was my first day, and I was on with one of my favorite doctors, who's just elegant, fantastic doc. And it was at this really moment where I just was done. I just didn't think I could go on any longer. And as I say, I was disillusioned. And we were eating in the cafeteria before our sort of crazy evening was going to start. And I got up to close this steel partition. And as I jerked it open and closed, it slammed on my hand and crushed my fingers. I actually thought they were amputated. And as I just took my hand out of it and I looked at it, it shows you how whacked I was. It was covered with blood, and I didn't have any fingers. And I just was like, oh, huh. Guess I'll have to put a bandage on it. Guess I amputated my fingers. And the doc and the interns jumped up, and they took me down to the emergency room. I passed out in the elevator. I collapsed. And when I woke up, I was in the emergency room myself as a patient, suddenly. And everything was different. I was lying there, and instead of this sort of brutal, exhausting, pointless experience of being the doc, I was lying there. And I opened my eyes, and there was an IV in, and I was wearing a patient gown, and this doctor, who I normally couldn't stand, was looking at me and sewing my fingers up. They hadn't been amputated, but they'd just been crushed. And suddenly my whole perspective changed as I realized how vulnerable I was and how he was the doctor. He was authoritative and wise and in control, and I was being a patient, passive, and grateful. And I understood at that point that the hospital was an archetype, a Jungian archetype of a place where you go when you can't take care of yourself, and that being a doctor was being an archetype of the thing that's called into being by the patient, right? Because we're always going to have illness, and we're always going to be patients, and the being of a patient is what calls in the archetype, the characteristics of the doc. And so when I got up after my fingers were sewn up and I went from that horizontal position to the vertical position, I found that my whole perspective had changed. And I suddenly kind of understood that despite all of its flaws, the hospital was a city on the hill, and I got to be part of it. So that was a turning point for me.
Tell us a little more about the archetype of the patient calls in the way of the physician. If you could clarify that a little more.
This gets back to the whole healthcare consumer idea, right? That you are a healthcare consumer. That's what the economists want you to be, right?
And healthcare is a commodity, yes.
And healthcare is a commodity, and you're a consumer. You're going to be, and you're supposed to be a wise consumer, because now you have, and this is what the word is, skin in the game, because it's become so expensive and you have to pay so much of your care. So you're going to be a wise consumer. But when you're a patient, you're not a consumer. You're not wise. You're not a consumer. You're terrified. You're in pain. You're suffering. You don't know what to do. And that's the nature of an illness. An accident, a burn, whatever it is that turns us into a patient, there's no other way for you to be. You will be that way. And because you were that way, it's the nature of being, I want to say a human, but then I think how wonderful my dog is, so I'm not sure, a sentient being, that the response to some being like that is to take care of them. And you, the kind of taking care you do responds to their passivity, you become active. They're helpless, you are helpful. They don't know what to do, you're wise, you're authoritative, you take control. That's what I mean by calling forth the archetype of the physician.
Have you come across resistance to those ideas?
No.
That's good.
But I might. But the biggest thing, I think the most interesting thing about what I'm doing and saying, and it's not just me. Fortunately, you know, this isn't like this has never occurred to anybody before. I mean, I'm a mouthpiece. This is just common sense, really. I mean, isn't it common sense to call a patient a healthcare consumer? That's really whacked. So there are two things about it. One is this is the truth. It's just truth. And the second thing is the difference between what I'm talking about and, let's say, if we consider this a social justice issue, which I don't, but if we did, sometimes people think it fits into that model that I'm talking about being nice, you know, and humane and good things, but is that healthcare economists also become patients.
And so do Congress people.
Everybody is going to become a patient. And their loved ones and their mothers and their fathers and their sisters and their brothers and their wives are going to become a patients. And at some point, everybody is going to have a conversion on the road to Damascus. Because you will not be able to buy, you can't buy this care that I'm talking about. You can be the richest person in the world, but if you get sick and you're doctors or healthcare providers, and you go into a hospital that's a factory for healing, you can have all the money in the world. They can put you in a fancy room. You can have better food than the rest of the people, but you're not going to get anything different because all your docs are going to be healthcare providers sitting there on the computer. So we all have a stake in making sure it. And down deep, I think everybody realizes that. So I think that's partly why you haven't gotten pushback, is that I think it's the truth and we all kind of know it. And there's a lot of people saying somewhat similar things. And down deep, everybody kind of knows that they don't want that to happen to them.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women, and I'm Corinne Fregoni. I have the pleasure of talking with Victoria Sweet, who just had her new book published, Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. And we've been discussing some of her experiences and how she's come to some of the conclusions that she's arrived at. Let's get back to the title of the book, Slow Medicine. What do you actually mean?
So it's a great question. I don't mean necessarily that it's actually slow. It's slow medicine as opposed to fast medicine. And fast medicine is the kind of healthcare providing we've been talking about. So it's slow medicine in that sense, as the opposite of healthcare providing. And in particular, it is slow in the sense that what I mean is something very simple. It's doctors and patients having enough time and a certain kind of time together to concentrate to get the right diagnosis and the right treatment. Pretty simple. So it's kind of the opposite of healthcare providing and fast medicine, in that fast medicine I sometimes lately think of as frantic medicine, rushed medicine, and costly medicine. And by the slow part of it, it's slow in the same way slow food is slow, in that it doesn't really take more time. It's a sort of a style. It's a style of creating space, of paying attention, taking responsibility, of being focused, and also in specific for the doctor and the patient, it's the doctor listening to the patient, trying to figure out what's actually wrong with the patient, physically examining the patient, and using his or her experience, thinking processes to try and figure out what's really wrong. And that sounds, I think, ridiculous. Like, of course that's what the doctor should do, right? But that's not what's going on anymore. There are 88 quality assurance measures that doctors are supposed to meet, and not one of them is about, did you get the right diagnosis? Did you get the right treatment? did the patient improve? None of them. It's crazy. So that's what I mean by slow medicine. Is that helpful or?
Very helpful. And also there's more, quote, evidence-based medicine that involves less and less contact, physical contact with the patient. Don't do a pelvic, don't do a breast exam, you know, all of these things,
right.
Because it doesn't show any difference in ultimate outcomes, whatever they are. Well, it sounds terrific.
Yes, whatever they are. Very good. Yes, thank you very much for that. That's right.
So, you know, of course, this sounds wonderful. Can you imagine a healthcare system that allows physicians to practice slow medicine or allows physicians, as you point out in your book very strongly, to combine the best of fast and slow medicine?
Very clearly, yes, I can. Here's why. Doctors actually have, in terms of time, we have almost the same amount of time we've always had with patients. The problem is it's all spent on the computer, and it doesn't have to be all spent on the computer. The problem is the computer and the actual programs that are running that computer that are taking all our time. So my focus from a practical sense is if we can get that time back, then doctors can do this, and if we don't get that time back, there's no way they can do it. So I'm actually going to focus on, I think if we just fix the electronic health records, which now take more than 100% of the doctor's time, and go back to something that I'm calling electronic paper chart, that has the way the paper chart was arranged but is electronic, we automatically, ipso facto, will get back our time, a lot of the time we had. And once we have the time back, then we can do it. But if we don't have the time back, we can't do it. Simple as that. So, yes, I can easily imagine.
I'm having a hard time imagining what this electronic paper chart is.
Basically, here's the issue. We got forced. Doctors in this country literally got forced. There was a law passed in 2009 that said every doctor has to have electronic health records. They just said that. And the electronic health records are lousy. They're built on a billing platform from the 1970s. And it was supposed to be more efficient and all kind of better, but you talk about no evidence. There was no evidence that ever showed that. And in fact, there is evidence that electronic health records takes anywhere between 70% of the doctor's time and 110%.
And it really is, like you said, about generating money and not about the doctor-patient relationship.
It isn't about it at all. It's about billing and it's about big data and all that stuff. But you can still generate money and have your big data. Right now, we are using doctors as data providers. That's actually what they're doing there. They're providing data for the system. They're not being doctors. And it doesn't have to be that way. It's a simple problem to solve. So when I say electronic paper charts, the paper chart was a book. Did you used to see them in your doctor's office?
Oh, my goodness. Piles and piles.
Yes.
Every morning I'd come into my office and there'd be a big pile of paper charts to go through. Yes.
What office?
I'm a doctor, too. I'm a family doctor.
Why did you tell me that? I forgot that.
It's okay.
Well, perfect. Okay. So what I mean by this, so the paper charts were books. It was a book with the name of the patient on it, and it had a beginning and a middle and an end, even though the end kept changing, right? So it was a story. It had a narrative to it, right? The electronic records is the opposite. It blows apart our story that we need as doctor detectives to figure out what's wrong with the patient. It blows it apart into little boxes, thousands of little boxes that were hunched over the computer filling in. That's what the electronic, it doesn't have to be that way. So what I'm imagining is just, patient comes to your office, you take an e-book out of the cloud. So it looks exactly like a paper chart, but it's made out of electrons. And it's got your name on it. And the doctor can open it up the way we open up an e-book and can write in it. We should be able to physically write in it with a stylus. We should be able to do, in this day of artificial intelligence, I see no reason why doctors need to be data providers, hunched over, filling in little boxes. We need the computer people to create AI that fits into the space between me being a doctor, examining a patient, sitting down with your chart, going through your chart, flipping around, looking at stuff, looking at your labs, yada, yada, yada. In electronic form is fine, but it should be in a codex, a book form. And then putting it back into the cloud, where it can be taken out of the cloud in the emergency room, in France, anywhere, and written in and looked at all over the world, it would be automatically interoperable. That's what I mean by an electronic paper chart.
I'm looking forward to that. Let's change topics a little bit. There have been a few studies that suggest women practice medicine a little differently than men, and some evidence that patients actually report a better experience when their physician is a woman, and some studies looking at whether that translates into better outcomes. What do you think? Do you think there's something about the way we female physicians are practicing that's different from the way men physicians practice? And is there something about women that brings them a little more in touch with your concepts of slow medicine?
It's really a great question, and it's kind of a loaded question.
So yes, it is.
I'm going to slither around it a bit. Here's why. I read the study, and I was tickled by that study. But what came up for me when I read that study, and it comes up again, is the face of one of my friends who's a guy who's, you know, he's really a woman. And I don't mean he's transgender or anything. I mean he's got that sensibility that we're talking about. And then another friend of mine who's a woman who has that other sensibility, that male sensibility, right? So that's what came up for me. So I think it's probably true. I mean, I believe the study, but I don't think it's because having an XX chromosome is what it's about. I think it's about women have both temperamentally and sociologically, we have a lot of the qualities that elicit comfort from patients more than I think XY chromosome people who are raised that way are. But I think rather to learn from that is the men need to get in touch with their womanliness inside of them and lead more with that is how I would interpret that study. And the men that are like that need to be encouraged to do that and vice versa.
I want to go back to your study of Hildegard von Bingen, because she was a woman. She was a nun and a composer and a healer, just a remarkable person. And I would love it if you could just give us another brief synopsis about her work and how that's contributed to your own thoughts.
Well, she was another turning point for me because when I discovered her work was when I'd finished my training. I'd been out in practice for a couple of years, and this whole model of healthcare providing was coming into the fore at the same time as I was realizing more and more deeply that there was just something missing from even the model that I was that had been using. I could see that there was a whole other thing going on between me and the patients and things that happened that surprised me. And I began looking around for another model that would fill that gap. And eventually I discovered Hildegard, who was a 12th century, as you say, nun and mystic and a medical practitioner. And she'd written this book on her medicine from the Middle Ages and had just been translated into English. And I discovered it by accident in the library, and I started reading it, and I was really surprised, first of all, that there was any books written by women from the Middle Ages. I didn't think there was practically any, that there was a medical book, and that this medical book that I was reading it was clearly not the eye of newt, toe of frog medicine I expected from a medieval medical text. It was for real patients with real diseases I could recognize. But, you know, it's based on a different model of the body than my own mechanical model. And so I went back to school, and I studied her, and gradually I realized that her model of the body was very common in the Middle Ages, and it was the model of the body as plant and the doctor as gardener. That's where I got it from. And that Hildegard had this notion that just like a plant has its own healing power, right? I mean, plants grow, and they get cut, and they fix themselves, and that the job of a gardener and the job of the doctor was for us to do that same sort of horticultural practice with our patients, that our job was to not so much to do something to the patient, but to remove what's in the way of his own natural healing power that Hildegard called viriditas. And I found that was sort of the basis of how I began to think about slow medicine when I discovered that, even before I was calling it slow medicine. This body as machine, and the body as the plant, and the doctor as mechanic, and the doctor as a gardener, and that we need both fast medicine and slow medicine, those two models, which I got, as I said, from Hildegard.
I love what you wrote at the end of your book. You said, as I did less and less with my patients, they got better and better.
It was very disconcerting, actually. After a while, I was like, am I some kind of quack? I mean, I just started doing nothing, Corinne. I don't know if that's happened to you, but I was like, I just feel like I was not doing anything anymore. It's like, well, here we were, just hanging out.
Oh, yes, that has happened. There is something about that relationship, that connection with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, I've been both a patient and a doctor as well, and I think it has definitely influenced my approach to my vocation. And I'm sorry that we're getting near the end. I want to ask you, are you glad you went into medicine? And if you hadn't, what would you have done?
Oh, wow. Great question. So, yes, I am extremely glad I went into medicine. I mean, I can't even imagine, even though I wasn't a natural doctor and nobody expected me to, and, you know, it was so difficult for my nature, because I'm not a natural, it was not comfortable for me, really. But it forced me, it allowed me to just grow into parts of myself that if I'd done something like become a professor of medieval studies, for instance, I never would have had. It would have been, right? So I just feel a much richer, fuller person. And I can tell that because when people write me, especially young students, you know, I've read your book and I want to be a doctor. And I like encourage them because I think it's a remarkable, I think it's a beautiful profession.
Thank you, Victoria, for sharing your thoughts about medicine and sharing your optimism and hope that we can do better practicing the science, art, and craft of medicine. That when a patient and a doctor leave the exam room, both feel that a connection was made that served the healing and health for one and the other. Thank you, Victoria.
That was beautiful. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I'm your host, Corinne Fragoni. My guest today was Dr. Victoria Sweet, author of Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. To learn more about Victoria's ideas, you can go to her website, victoriasweet.com. Through the Eyes of Women is a collaborative effort produced for KHSU located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Jesse Eden. You can listen to this show again at khsu.org or visit our blog at khsuwomen.com where you can post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30 here on KHSU.